And Chair apologizes for being late, but it's getting to that part of the session where things are moving rather quickly. We're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2336. Jan Shea.
Jan Shea. 2336, first bill up.
Good evening, members. My name is Jan Shea. I'm Assistant Appellate Legal Counsel to the Supreme Court and Court of Appeals, and I'm here on behalf of A. Engrossed Bill 2336. This bill will do a number of things. First, it will require that all appealable decisions be titled judgment. We've had some problems with that because it said order in the past. The second thing it will do is require that a post-judgment order be a final order in order to be appealable. And it will also delete from some statutes provisions that deem certain juvenile court actions appealable even though they are not final. It will also clarify that juvenile case appeals are conducted in the same manner as civil cases generally. And it sorts out certain provisions that are now contained in ORS 419A200 into their own freestanding statutes. Did you want me to go through the provisions?
Nope. I want to do this very quickly. Mike Livingston.
Is there an
amendment to this bill?
Just the A. Engross.
We have just the A. Engross bill. No amendments beyond it. Yes. Mike.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just briefly, I want to note that another bill that's up for work session today, 2388, also has amendments to the Juvenile Appeals Statute 419A200, and that bill and this bill are harmonious in that respect, even though they're not exact matches on the changes they make in that section. Just to say that they are harmonious on that point.
No conflicts between the two.
No conflicts.
All right. Good. So we're basically just codifying the existing procedures and trying to make it more clear the basis from which appeals out of juvenile court.
That's correct.
Okay. Work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2336A engrossed to the Senate floor due pass for a recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2336A engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass. Recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Carrier? Senator Courtney will carry the bill. House Bill 2379, work session. Excuse me, public hearing.
You don't need to use them also.
Peter.
What? David Fidanke? You're David? Andrea? I didn't realize.
Okay.
It's not for any
other
reason.
Now, are you here? David was supposed to be gone.
Pardon?
David Fidanke is supposed to have to go to another meeting.
Yes.
And I was accommodating him, but why don't I take the proponents of the bill first, because you guys are kind of on the bubble here.
Right, because our problem may be taken care of.
Okay, why don't you sit back. We'll talk to get Sergeant Dave Golladay, Portland Police Bureau. Who is the sponsor of the bill, for gosh sakes? I'm going by the people who signed up first.
Looks like criminal defense lawyers.
This is a defense attorney bill?
It is.
How did this get on
here? Mr. Chair, my name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. To give you a little bit of an idea of the history of this bill, we asked this bill to be introduced originally to remove a person who is writing a mass transit bus while excluded from the mass transit bus from the unauthorized use of motor vehicle statute. That is a person who's riding, but the actual bus driver is driving. It's not somebody who is actually stealing the bus. That would not be included in this. So that's what subsection 3 on page 1, lines 20 through 22, accomplished. Section 3 is the accommodation for the Portland Police Department and TriMet to allow them to take into custody certain people who are causing them problems at their transit stations and on the bus. And it's a replacement of the, I believe it's called interference with public transportation, which is right now in ORS 166-155. There were a couple of concerns about the language, and I believe that we are working out those concerns, and that includes subsection C, that would be page 2, lines 4 through etc., that's basically a disorderly conduct. We're trying to make disorderly conduct at a public transit vehicle or a public transit station Class A misdemeanor, and so we're probably going to have an amendment that would incorporate that kind of language into this bill.
Okay. So you have an amendment to this bill, but you have not gotten that draft?
No, it's from the TriMet has the suggested language, the suggested amendment that we have no problem with.
All right. Okay. All right. Are you done?
I am done. Thank you.
Everybody want to know why this bill's here? Some prosecutor actually prosecuted somebody for riding light rail without a ticket, because it technically comes under the UUMV statute, and that's why the technical correction. So, a little embarrassing for the prosecution, but I say, person pled guilty.
Thank you.
All right. Didn't have a ticket.
We all did not have a ticket. And that's 39, but we're not doing anything on it.
All right.
Well, we're just not moving it.
Hey, yo, Bernie? Do you have an amendment to this thing?
Mr. Chairman, we do. A3 amendment, but we became aware of concerns from the ACLU and thought possibly from the criminal defense attorneys day before yesterday, so we held off and try to talk with them, and I think we've reached an agreement that will solve all of our problems on the bill.
So you don't have the amendment?
No.
What is the amendment? What are you trying?
Well, there are two things that we're trying to do. We wanted to amend the House bill to correct some problems, and we have had agreement on that. What it does is it adds language that says enters or remains in line 27 on the first page, intentionally or knowingly enters or remains unlawfully on or in or on a public transit facility. That just gives us the ability to prosecute people who we are trying to exclude for the first time, but they're refusing to leave. The other is to add definitions that are currently in the trespass statute for what enters or remains means. So we're using existing language there. So those are the amendments that we would propose, had proposed, and we got agreement with the criminal defense attorneys on.
Why do you want that again?
Well, we need to be able to – enters allows us to deal with people who enter the system, but there was a concern that we couldn't prosecute an individual who refused to leave the system. So that's why we asked for the enters or remains language. And the reason for the definition was just because it's not, the enters or remains is not defined in this section of the statute.
Okay. All right. Officer?
Mr. Chair, I've passed out a copy of the language the ACLU had a problem with. That was not the language we originally agreed upon with the Oregon criminal defense attorney. Someone changed that, but the fix I forwarded to you, which is represented at the bottom of the page in section C, I think has been agreed upon by all parties, the ACLU, the OCDLA, and it would just refer back to the already well-known statutory language in the disorderly conduct statute 166025, which has been litigated, decided upon by the Supreme Court, and found to be constitutional, so there should not be any free speech problems with that section.
All right. What's your name?
Mike Holbach.
Mike Holbach? Who are you with?
Multnomah County District Attorney's Office.
You are? No. How long you been there?
About 8 years.
8 years?
You better stop.
Oh, hidden in the drug unit. Okay. I don't remember ever seeing you. Okay.
You're going to see the poor guy. He's really...
No, he'll probably end up being the next prosecutor in one of my key cases.
His face looks good.
He doesn't look hurt.
He looks hurt to me.
He looks fine. David?
I just have to add, Mr. Chairman and committee, that this will help us out immensely on the transit system with the number of chronic offenders we have that are repeated offenders. Making it a class A misdemeanor will help us actually lodge these people and be more of a deterrent to what they know now is not a deterrent. And there's not much we can do to them. Doing this will actually add some bite to the law and help us with our job, actually deter these folks from doing it again. And repeat offenders so far have not recidivized yet. So it's definitely going to help us out.
All right. Senator Courtney.
Officer, who are you?
Sergeant Galladay, Portland Police.
Oh, you Portland Police? Okay.
Do you know him?
We've met, I think, once before, but, you know, I've been a detective for a long time. I'm kind of isolated up in that ivory tower.
Do you know him?
Oh, yeah.
I have been at officer-involved shootings, and I've never met the sergeant, and I've never met the lieutenant in Portland, Lynchboro, just so you know.
Did you say shootings?
Yeah. Anyway, any other questions?
He's a sergeant, isn't he?
No other questions. Okay, now we got another amendment. What we're going to do, how long is it going to take to get an amendment for this thing?
Not very long. They've got it pretty much.
15 minutes?
Call
Virginia and see if she freaks out.
She'll freak out.
She will? Okay.
Because this is it.
She'll freak out.
She's got it done.
What? We're waiting for the printer to spit it out?
It takes a little while to get it.
Okay. All right. We're working out some technical problems here. You guys can stand down. I've got another gentleman who has another amendment, I think.
Yeah.
Correct?
Nola?
Nola?
Can you hand out that amendment?
Joel, you're up. We're going to talk about bicycles.
And pedestrians.
And pedestrians, at my suggestion. Now, the ACLU may not... I hope you don't freak out on this. You haven't seen it? Do you ride bikes? It'll protect you. It has nothing to do with free speech.
Jeez, that's the only thing that's probably Bill right there, isn't it?
All right, Joel, want to share your heart with us here?
I'd love to.
Okay.
If you've got nothing better to do, I feel sorry for you. But I'm Joel Shapiro. I'm a legislative aide to Representative Beck, who cannot be here, sends his apologies, and asked me to explain briefly the -A4 amendment to this bill. It's pretty simple. It borrows the language from assault for regarding physical injury from the offenses against persons section of the criminal code and adds it to section 811 of the vehicle code, the part that includes duties to pedestrians and bicyclists, to clarify that if there's an accident that where a motorist was at fault and it results in a physical injury to a bicyclist or a pedestrian, that should, in fact, be included as an assault and charged as an assault. And this arose from a former constituent of ours who was involved in a situation like this twice, and in neither case was an assault charge issued. It was issued as merely an infraction, whereas an assault, of course, would be a misdemeanor. And in both instances, the officer who responded to the scene determined that the motorist had caused the collision. There was... physical injury. The rider was unconscious and taken away by the paramedics. In the second instance, he was found later to have been in a coma state while he was unconscious, and it just resulted in an infraction, basically similar to a parking ticket. So we're asking to make this logical and clear for officers when they respond to a scene that this be included in the vehicle code duties to pedestrians and cyclists. If there's any questions.
All right. And any questions?
One further clarification. This is not meant to supersede other assault charges, like an assault one or assault two, in an instance where the elements would rise to that level.
Right. Now, you're an attorney, right?
I am an attorney.
Okay. So a physical injury is just that injury that occurs for a momentary period of time. It's not permanent or protracted.
Well, there's case law on that, that certainly the attorneys would have the opportunity to litigate it if the case went to trial. But I think the working definition is if it causes pain that lasts for more than an hour, there's clear case law on what constitutes physical injury. If somebody bumps someone in the knee and they say, oh, boy, you know, it caused a little scrape, that's not going to be considered a physical injury.
Okay. And recklessly operates a vehicle. Well, that's not getting, you know, being on your cell phone and not paying attention, is it?
Well, Chairman, Minister, members of the committee, again, that would probably be something that would have to be litigated, but we need a mental state. It would be reckless if a jury could determine that it was reckless. If it put somebody at a substantial risk of injury, they can consider that conduct to be reckless, but that would have to be a matter for the jury to determine, I would believe.
Okay. Good question. Senator Metzger.
I'm a little confused on this as to why this would be necessary, because if you had a situation where someone was cited for under 161085 for operating recklessly as it's defined in current statute, that you would have this action anyway. I mean, it's already in the statute that if you drive recklessly and you're cited for that, wanton disregard for normal care of a person, and they hit you on a bicycle, that there is that penalty already, and your rights are already there. I just understand this sounds duplicitous to me.
Well, Chairman, Senator Metzger, I would agree that in a situation that you're probably envisioning, it could be charged, but the fact of the matter is, in most instances, it's not charged. This was specifically inspired by a constituent of Representative Becks, who was twice involved in a cycling accident in a bike lane, and in neither case, after determining that it was the motorist's fault, was the motorist issued with any kind of criminal citation. So it was not reckless driving, it was not assault four, which it could be considered an assault four, but our feeling is that there should be a provision within the section of the code that's duties to pedestrians and bicyclists, which says if you cause a physical injury, which is a separate element from recklessness of driving, but if there is a physical injury, that should warrant an assault, a misdemeanor assault. So it's not duplicitous in the sense of creating an exact same charge, because it has additional elements of the injury.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, the only question I was asking is that you still have the step in the case that you articulated is that they were not cited for reckless driving. And this doesn't change that. It's still the same standard. I mean, it says the person recklessly operates a vehicle. So if the officer didn't cite then, he's not going to cite now if he didn't think it was reckless.
Chairman, Senator Metzger, part of the reason for this is that by putting this change in the law, when the officers go through their training about the new changes that the legislature has passed in the session, I mean, every time there's a legislative session, the DAs and the officers go through a training, and this will be something that will be highlighted, that if there is this kind of an instance where a pedestrian or a bicyclist is injured due to the fault of the motorist, you should be charging it as a misdemeanor. So I think it will raise that awareness level. And also, I would add that in speaking to some officers about this, they have a little bit different of idea of what constitutes reckless driving than might be connoted by the term reckless in the mental state requirement for this misdemeanor.
Okay. It is, to some extent, redundant, but I think we had this discussion the other day. I think the problem is that a lot of officers at the scene of one of these accidents might cite a person for careless driving, or they might cite them for some other infraction, as opposed to looking at the seriousness of the injury that the person might receive. By the time an officer cites on some of the violation, that's going through the process, and in order for it to come to the attention of the district attorney, there would literally have to be some reports or something that were forwarded to the district attorney for their review. They then might intercede and make sure that traffic citation didn't move forward while they had an opportunity to get additional information and perhaps charge the person. So having that ability to charge up front and bring it to the incident office might expedite these kind of charges under these circumstances. Senator Burdick.
Chairman, let me understand this. Right now, under current law, if a person recklessly operates a motor vehicle, that's reckless driving, and that is, what, a Class A misdemeanor? Or is, what kind of offense is that now?
Chairman, it's Senator Burdick. I believe it's a Class A. It may be a Class B misdemeanor.
My concern is, here, the standard that you put in here is they have to be not only reckless, but they have to cause a physical injury. So, you know, would you maybe misguide the enforcement officers by saying, well, if the person isn't hurt, then that's not enough to charge them under this, whereas under the existing statute, reckless is reckless. I guess I'm concerned about reducing.
Chairman and Senator Burdick, the major concern, as I said earlier, was that in these cases, they don't get charged with anything. And there are certainly many cases out there where you would be able to support a reckless driving charge, and it's not issued. I don't believe that this would detract from any cases where you'd have a reckless driving charge and you would say, well, there was no injury, so we would have charged it as reckless driving, but we're not. That's simply not the problem that people are encountering. They're encountering the reverse problem of there's reckless driving and no charge at all.
Chairman, just to follow up, why would you put the reckless standard in there at all? I mean, if the bicyclist was operating legally and the car hit the bicyclist, because the rules of the road already say that you can't go around hitting bicyclists that are operating legally, why would you put the reckless standard in there at all? Why don't you just make the physical injury the standard?
Chairman and Senator Burdick, every criminal charge requires a mental state, a requisite mental state. So it's, you either have to say intentionally, recklessly, or not negligently.
Mr. Chairman, members, any criminal charge, you have to have a mental state. It does go down to criminal negligence in the statutes, which is different from just normal negligence that your personal injury attorney would be trying to prove in a civil case. But I think what this law does is it does parallel assault 4. If I were, as a prosecutor, saw a police report where a bicyclist was injured, I would look at it, and the charge that would come to me would be an assault 4 charge, recklessly caused physical injury. And I think that this does parallel it, and as Mr. Shapiro had pointed, it would put assault 4 is in the criminal code, this would be in the vehicle code, and I think the idea behind that is that the vehicle code is a bit more accessible to officers.
So this would parallel the assault 4 section as opposed to the reckless driving.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Burdick, reckless driving, you don't have to prove any physical injury. If I were a prosecutor and a guy, for example, was weaving through 5 o'clock traffic and never caused an injury, he still can be recklessly driving. If the prosecutor can prove the reckless mindset, which I think we've tried to talk about before, but which means that they were aware of the risk of driving that way and then they departed from that, and that was I think it's a substantial departure that I need to get the definition of reckless. So it most closely parallels assault 4 in that it's reckless mindset with physical injury.
Let me just cut to the chase here. As a former prosecutor, a current prosecutor on leave, would this result in more prosecutions in this scenario where a car hits a bicyclist?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, not to my mind. What it would do, again, is I think it makes a difference of how the officers at the initial, you know, remembering that the DA doesn't see it until there's actually been a report written. If there were a case where the officer did not charge any crime, some of those cases might get through the system where no DA would review it. But typically, this is if a district attorney sees a report like this where a pedestrian is injured by a reckless driver, they're going to charge it. They're going to charge assault 4. So
already?
Yes. If it gets to the prosecutor. I don't know if that...
Chairman, Senator Burdick, if I could also attempt to answer that. The intent is to really try to help the officers at the scene more so than the DAs per se, but to help the officers who are looking at their vehicle code when they get to the scene of an accident and aren't thinking about the offenses against persons section somewhere else, but they're actually looking at their vehicle code, and they see we've got a situation here that involved a pedestrian or a bicyclist. Here's a section in 811, which is called Duties to Pedestrians and Cyclists, that somewhere in there, they're going to see here we have an assault, and that's what the proper charge in this instance should be, and it will support that, and then it will get charged that way.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator, I want to make one more point, too. Nothing prevents the officer from charging an assault for. An officer can charge that on a ticket, but it's not done as much, and when usually those crimes are added by the prosecutors.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
They need that amendment, apparently.
Andrea Meyer, you want to step forward? Do you have an amendment? ACLU has an amendment?
No.
You don't have any amendment?
Nobody.
Vice Chair. Just a minute, Andrea. There's something will happen here. Speak.
Huh?
All right, this is a signal. Watch this, Andrea. You want an amendment, whether you know it or not, that you don't have written yet. Did you know that?
Something like Vice Chair Courtney, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. What I've seen is a May 10th memo from TriMet that I believe was handed out to you and that reflects our concerns and addresses it by amending Section, I believe, 3C, to make it the disorderly conduct rather than the expensive language.
And
we're comfortable. Pardon?
Which will take an amendment.
Which will take an amendment.
Which we do not have before us.
Apparently you do not.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions at this time? Very good.
Thank you.
Let's close this thing down. Close the public hearing work session on the bill in which there are amendments, no amendments, and some amendments. Oh, yes. This gets fun. I'd like to open the public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2380. Senator and High Council.
Yes. I'm ready to move it.
Let me go get the.
Yeah.
You want me to tell them? I think Mr. Vice Chairman Kevin Campbell's here with some people from Beaverton, the mayor of Beaverton, and the chief of police. I think they were the first signed up for this bill.
Okay. This is the bill that involves. Well, traffic signals.
Red bill should stop.
It's called the red light bill. Okay, Kevin, you got your group. Come forward.
So is this the one?
Bring them all.
Beaverton, the red light district. Is that?
This is
Beaverton, Newburgh.
Is that all of you?
It depends on how many you'd like, Mr. Chair. We have a couple rounds.
That's not what I got here. Where's Mark?
Wow.
Park Landers.
Mark's here. Where's Sergeant?
I'm going, Kevin. Where's Sergeant?
Tell me to.
Where's he?
I have too much. You got it now.
Kevin, who's Dino?
This is Chief Walt Myers, City of Salem.
Right, he's my chief.
We're signed up together, and then there's, I think, three from the City of Beaverton. And then Mark Landauer from the City of Portland, if I'm correct.
And that's, okay. I got the Mayor of Drake from Beaverton. I got the Chief of Staff, City of Beaverton. Geez, Beaverton's here. Okay, whatever you want to do, please go ahead, please.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Kevin Campbell. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and with me, Chief Walt Myers from the City of Salem. We're here to support House Bill 2380, as it's arrived to you in the B engrossed form, we are the ones that have requested this bill from the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I'd like to very briefly run down the key components of the bill. Then Chief Myers will go into more detail about why we're here. I want to start by saying that House Bill 2380 authorized cities with populations over 30,000 to use camera enforcement at intersections. There's one exception to that I'll mention in a minute. But last session, there was a bill that was passed that authorized the pilot project in this area. This actually now creates a standard above 30,000.
It's permissive language in the bill, which means it's a may and not a shall. City councils can determine if this is an appropriate enforcement technique for their locality. There's a public awareness component in the bill. It requires cities to provide a public information campaign to inform local drivers of the program before a citation is ever issued. It has a signage requirement. This is important to the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police because we don't want this program to be a gotcha program. We're interested in deterrence, and so this requires signage at intersections prior to the vehicle reaching the intersection that warns that the intersection is being patrolled with these cameras. The bill requires a process and an outcome evaluation, which means that the Department of Transportation is going to submit an executive summary at every session to the Legislative Assembly by March of each one of those sessions that talks about the process and outcome evaluations of the program. A few more. Has the intersection limitation. At no time can there be more than four intersections with operational cameras in any city with the exception of Portland, which has eight. The city, the exception I mentioned to the 30,000 population rule is the city of Newburgh. Newburgh was involved in the pilot project last session. They're the only city technically that falls under that 30,000 population limit. And this removes, House Bill 2380, removes the sunset provision that was in House Bill 2071 from last session. With that, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'll turn over the remaining comments from our association to Chief Walt Myers.
Thank you, Kevin. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, on Saturday, May 2, 1998, Oregon Trail Elementary fifth grader Aaron Kennedy and two friends waited for the walk sign before crossing busy Highway 212 to go to McDonald's for lunch. As Aaron walked through the marked crosswalk, a car blew through the red light, striking the boy and tossing him at least 20 feet. He died 4 hours later. He died 5 days short of his 11th birthday. On January 13th, Catalia Briley, the woman charged with Aaron Kennedy's death, was found guilty of second-degree manslaughter, reckless driving, felony hit-and-run, and reckless endangering. When the traffic signal turns red, drivers stop. Or do they? There's a growing body of evidence that many drivers do not. Perhaps congestion, impatience, and reckless driving all contribute to the growing problem of drivers deliberately running red lights. According to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety's Highway Loss Data Institute estimates, each year more than 800 people die and more than 200,000 are injured in crashes that involve red light running. In Oregon, over the last 10 years, drivers running red lights were responsible for an average of 1,860 non-fatal crashes, 650 injury crashes, and 5 fatal crashes each year. Not only are traffic signal violations dangerous and costly, but they are also difficult to enforce through conventional law enforcement strategies. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, 1999 report, crashes at traffic signal intersections accounted for 2,803 fatalities. There were an additional 493,000 injuries at these intersections in the same year. At intersections, observation of red light violations is difficult, and pursuit of violators can put motorists, pedestrians, and officers at risk. Traffic engineers design the intersections to make the maximum use of the land purchased for the right-of-way and to make intersections operate as efficiently as possible. Roadways run from curb to curb, and adjacent to the roadways are sidewalks or bike paths. In these situations, even if an officer can find a place to safely observe the intersection, there is often no safe or effective way to stop a red light runner without following the violator through a red light. Carefully targeted tools like photo red light help address difficult enforcement challenges at intersections, provide enforcement coverage 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and free officer time to respond to other pressing public concerns. According to the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety, preliminary crash data from localities using photo red light enforcement indicates that the number of intersection crashes has decreased significantly and that the programs are reducing red light running by about 40%. Data from Oxnard, California shows that red light violations have decreased throughout the community, not only at intersections with cameras. According to a public opinion poll conducted by Lewis Harris for Advocates for Highway and Auto Safety, 74% of Americans favor state laws that permit cities to install cameras at intersections to catch those who ignore traffic signals. We urge you to support HB 2380. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Questions? I want to make sure of one thing, running high council, because I overheard one of my fellow senators prior to this saying, well, at least they're going to take six cities out of this. They are not taking six cities. Basically, by saying in the language that says on line 9-8, any city with a population of 30,000 or more, with that language, you keep in the Beaverton, Bend, Medford, Portland, and Tigard. Is that correct?
Vice Chairman, that is correct. I think it's still discretionary for the cities,
right.
But as I recall from the 99, that was kind of a test thing.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm trying to say that there's a perception by at least one member of this committee that if we pass this, we're going to dump those cities. Those cities are included by that population number.
Mr. Vice Chairman, this is an expansion of the use of
correct.
Not a limitation.
Didn't mean to confuse you, gentlemen. It's something I wanted to clarify.
Thank you
very much for coming here and opening the testimony on House Bill.
Thank you.
Sure, John. 2380B. Do you want to?
2380B.
So we've done this, they're here, it's somewhere in here.
All right. Anybody in opposition to this? No opposition?
Let me move it.
Work session, 2380.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2380 be engrossed to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2380 be engrossed to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objections.
Yeah.
Senator Harper objects. Senator Beyer objects. Senator Metzger objects. The vote is then.
Senator Harper had his hand up as well. That's good. That's
voting against it. So
4-3.
4-3. Motion passes.
Now we're going to get into it. I want this.
Senator Duncan, good to carry it.
Duncan will carry. This is not a Duncan-esque bill.
Well, every now and then you've got to
step out. And then you have to step out.
I hope you don't feel bad that you didn't get to testify. All right. We're not trying to hurt your feelings or anything. It's just.
I was moving forward. Yes.
I was afraid we were going to have to hear from the former legislator.
Mayor Beaverton. Who else? We had the mayor.
The mayor's here?
Mayor Beaverton. Right.
Sorry.
There he is.
Me.
Right there.
I would have called you up first if I'd have known that.
Thank you.
Do good things with it. Okay, let's see.
I can't believe you're
knowing that. That was a lot before. I was worried if I was going to go, no, you're going to have to rest because you thought it was guns or something. You know, you stole their bill again.
Now we can go.
Did Vern? Check with me, baby.
Nah,
I'm a Marine. We'll go up the hill on this one, baby.
What are we going to find?
Hmm?
Okay.
When they're sleeping, we'll hit them.
Okay.
When they're in their trundle bed.
Let's bring a caution light first.
Public hearing 2391.
It's a good deal.
That's a good news, New York.
I like it now.
Now we're kicked off. We're flat out here. We're getting into it.
Just go ahead and speak up. Don't mind these guys there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Osborne, senior attorney. The Juvenile Rights Project. This is a bill that comes out of the Juvenile Code Revision of the Oregon Law Commission, and basically it's making two changes regarding the termination of parental rights cases. The first would be that at citizen review hearings and court hearings during the dependency proceeding, parents would be asked what their contact information is, and including the phone numbers, their current addresses, and the current address and phone number of somebody that would know how to get in contact with them. The provision also has, the change also has a provision where if it's appropriate, the court could enter a court order limiting disclosure of that information. The purpose for this is when it comes time to file termination of parental rights petitions, the parents have to be served with those petitions, and oftentimes in dependency cases, parents will drop out of sight, be nowhere to be found, and no one knows how to get a hold of them, and we have to go through the time period of trying to find them, and then also the expense of, if we can't find them, of serving them through notice, usually published in newspapers. This would have, at least we would have the last known contact information where it might speed up that process, where we would be actually be able to contact the parents and be able to serve them faster. The second change is codifying the requirements regarding a letter of expectations. Currently, when children are taken into care, SCF is required by statute and by policy to develop a service plan with the parents. If the parents are asked to sign the service plan, if they refuse to sign the service plan, then after a period of time, SCF policy requires the agency to send out what's known as a letter of expectation to the parents of what services they expect the parents to take part in and complete before reunification would be able to occur and the timeline that they need to do this. And then, that's it. I'm sorry, apparently that second change was taken out. So you can forget that. It's only about the contact information.
I'm Michael Livingston with the Department of Justice. There is another section of the bill. It has a completely different purpose. The bill, that's section 3. And it says a parent who believes or claims that financial health or other problems will prevent or delay the parent's compliance with an order of the court must inform the court of the relevant circumstances as soon as reasonably possible, and if appropriate, seek relief from the order under 419B-420. This amendment proposal was in response to a particular case, the Burke termination case, which is set out in the written testimony. In that case, the father had been ordered as a condition of his parole and later as a condition of the juvenile court that he participate in sex offender treatment. For the first time in over a two-year period at the termination trial before the court, he argued that he couldn't afford to do it, and that's why he hadn't completed sex offender treatment. Although he could have done this, could have brought the matter to the juvenile court's attention, he didn't. And the result of that was the court found that he couldn't have paid for it and denied the termination petition. What this bill would do, what this amendment would do, would be in a situation like that, if the parent believes that he or she can't comply with the court's order, it changes the may from to must, basically. The parent must bring that to the court's attention and get that matter resolved early on in the case. And I would add that I think this is particularly important in light of the changes that the Senate made to the juvenile code in the last session, which speeds up the timelines for getting children into permanent placement. That's Senate Bill 408, I believe. And so that's the reason for this change. It basically changes the may to a must. If the parent's got a problem with the court's order, the parent needs to bring that to the court's attention, or it won't be an excuse later on. Thank you.
All right. It's been said on this committee, why do it? It appears dumb. Tell us why it's not dumb.
Which part?
The idea. Either. I don't know. Kathy, you tell us why your part isn't a bad idea.
Why your part
is not. Defend yourself.
Currently, as I said, what happens is there's no requirement for parents to make, for courts or citizen review boards who have contact with the parents to require the parents to give up their contact information. And oftentimes that can be a problem, and then if the parent drops out of sight, we can't find them to serve them, which means we have to go through a process before you can publish by notification, post by, or give notice by posting or publication. You have to be able to show to the court that you've done everything you can to try to find this individual. When our office is prosecuting termination of parental rights, that includes us having to use our investigator time to go out and search at last known addresses, search for DMV for addresses, that sort of stuff. It takes time, which means kids are sitting there waiting for their parents' rights to be terminated when the parents have left.
Okay, that's enough. Mike, actually, I liked your explanation. Basically, somebody didn't complete sex offender treatment. They argued that they couldn't afford it, and there was basically, they were given leniency by the court because
they waited for the 2 years to bring that up.
Right. Basically. Right.
Works.
Mr. Chair, I, oh, Mr. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, there aren't any amendments, is that correct, Laverne High Council? Thank you, Supreme Leader. I move House Bill 2391, engross the Senate floor, do pass, Mr. Chair.
All right, Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2391, engross to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
It's not engrossed, right?
It is, isn't it, engrossed?
Engrossed.
I say engrossed.
That was my mistake, they took out the part that I started talking about.
It's not engrossed?
It is engrossed.
I know what I'm, an engrossed bill could not come before us as a House bill unless it didn't come out of the House engrossed, Laverne High Council. You don't just make up stuff like that.
Any further discussion that makes sense? Any objections? Hearing none.
So ordered.
No, I'm not.
Senator Byer refuses to carry the bill. Senator Burdick, would you be so kind?
I'd be delighted.
Thank you very much. All right.
Don't even look this way.
Look, the boss's bill next.
Which one's his?
803?
What's the wrong agenda? There's no 803.
There's no 803 in our agenda.
What's in my packet? So it's got me on.
Oh, okay. That's for sure.
You're telling me my staff man is safe.
No, I'm saying whatever's in your jacket, that's the agenda.
Let's do it.
Work session, House Bill 2100.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, House Bill 2100 is the bill that we heard testimony on, I believe, last week. This is the bill that basically deals with when an inmate is released, the Department of Corrections would not like to have the inmates released on a Friday, or excuse me, on a Saturday, Sunday, or legal holiday. The bill came to us from the House, but it did not expressly mention ballot measure 11 and another section, which is called the Denny Smith Determinate Sentences section. So if you look at 2100-2, this specifically states that for this purpose of moving the release date up to 3 days, this applies to ORS 137.700, which is commonly referred to as ballot measure 11. It also applies to what I had mentioned earlier, which is ORS 137.635, commonly referred to as the determinate sentences or Denny Smith section. I don't know why they call it that, to be honest. So the dash two amendments were before us, I think, last week. I think they have the support of the sheriffs, the DAs, the Department of Corrections, and I just wanted to double check and make sure what the amendment did to ballot measure 11, and I'm satisfied that it would only change it 3 days. So the release date would be on a Sunday. They could move it forward to Friday.
Crime Victims United, where are they?
Where are they?
Steve Dole, down the hall. I want to reach out there. He is right now.
Where's my amendment? Everybody gets released on Tuesday.
All right, this does...
Too radical.
This requires two-thirds vote?
It does.
Okay, it does require two-thirds vote, so we just want to make sure that it didn't do something it wasn't supposed to do to ballot measure 11. This is a work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2100.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 2100. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to move House Bill 2100 as amended to the Senate floor of the due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2100 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer.
Thank you. I missed the hearing on the bill.
Okay.
I apologize for that. When the Department of Corrections came to my office and talked to me about this bill, I asked them if there were some things that they could do possibly administratively, or rather than having to release up to 3 days early, something such as we're building a new intake center in Wilsonville. Most of the prisoners come out of the Mountain Valley. Why not? Or could they have an outgoing center along with an intake center so that a week or 10 days or something before, when they've got a van going one way or another from one of these outlying prisons, if they couldn't put the person in the van, bring them to where it's close to where they're going to be released, or they can be released, you know, there, and so they don't have to be released early. Was that addressed at all in the hearing?
No, we didn't discuss those issues at all.
They just blew you off.
No, I would have asked the question had I been here. Now Claudia is here.
Claudia, you want to come up here and get up?
Mr. Chair.
No, and I don't want to be there yet, but it's just...
I'm just kidding. I'm being facetious. Cindy Scott up.
Wasn't the part of the issue the fact that people are released and then none of the facilities were at home? I mean, having the parole officer available and all that on weekends.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much just the release part, but it was having some... Then they get in trouble on the weekend. Now, here they are out with a few dollars in their pocket and...
And they show up at my office on Friday afternoon and want to register as sex offenders.
Well, I guess that's my point, is that, you know, do we have to release them in Ontario? I mean, couldn't we put them on a, you know, keep them in custody until they get to where they're supposed to be going? Because they have to go back to their hometown. Is that correct?
Scott, do you want to respond?
Chairman, Senator Beyer. The intent of this bill is not, first of all, to apply it to everybody who's getting out. What we hope to do is take those people who have the furthest to go and try and use it sparingly where that makes the most sense when we have a plan that needs to be done. We can move people to county jails ahead of time if we have an agreement with the county jail and if they have the space. But because of the intake process they go through and the housing they go through and the capacity they do or don't have at certain times, we would have to carve out a certain place and hold those beds, usually with a rental agreement. So the cost of doing that. So there are some counties we talk to about releasing people to their work release centers or to their jails, but it is not a universal around the state. We do have a transport system that moves bodies, but again, they need to house them somewhere, and that is the primary concern with the local custodians.
Well, I guess, you know, I'm just trying to find out if there's a way that this process could be facilitated without making a vote like this. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of like the legislature meets every other year in January, and yet we seem to sneak up on the process every time and people aren't ready for us to get here. And I'm just wondering if, you know, the same thing, we know when these release dates are going to be. It isn't like they sneak up on you and all of a sudden, whoa, it's here. Is there a way administratively we could, you know, you could start moving your population as these, you know, it doesn't have to be the day before, month before, when you got, you know, just start managing, because we're gonna soon have prisons built all over the state, so you could house these people, I would think, is somewhere, you know, start moving them back close to home.
Chairman and Senator Beyer, part of the reorganization we're doing in the way we house people within the institutions, we are moving more and more to a regional releasing point, and we are moved, so the people going to the eastern side of the state will be coming out of an eastern facility. The people coming that are going to be released in the valley will be coming out of valley institutions. That allows us to get them closer to where they're going to be going. That's why we also think the number of people we'll be using this with will go down considerably. So we're trying to get closer, as close as we can.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
You know, maybe I didn't make my point clear enough. From what I understood in the testimony, it isn't so much the logistics of getting them around where you're going to release them and so forth. It's upon release, and they're out in the cold, cruel world, is there support for them at that particular point? And if you let them out on a Saturday or a Sunday or Friday night, you know, the parole officer's not available, the different kind of services are not available to those people at that particular point, right?
Yes, that is one of the major problems we face.
It was not the logistics of getting them out. It was what, once they're released, you're out in the free world now, on parole probably, but how do you deal with them out there? Because, you know, it's easy to get in trouble that first weekend, and all of a sudden you end up back in jail again.
As it was expressed to me when we were talking about it in my office, was that the issue a lot of times is they're released on a Friday. By the time they're released out of Ontario on Friday, they got to go to Eugene. By the time they get to Eugene, it's Friday night and it's closed. So if you can release them one day early, at least they can get to Eugene and time to register on it's not just the weekend. It was, you know, it was also pretty, you know, sometimes a holiday, I mean, just, you know, toward the end of the week. Or would there be another option to lengthen their sentence by 3 days until Monday?
I don't know that we can do that. I think the sentences are determinate for Measure 11.
Determinate, Senator Beyer, because the day they come in, they have a specific date that is the max date that we can hold them. That's the date we have to let them out.
Mr. Chair, aren't those sentences set in statute? Couldn't we add 3 days to each sentence in statute?
You could do that, yes.
Up to 3 days?
Still take two-thirds vote, but you could do that.
Well, it only takes two-thirds vote to reduce a sentence.
Well, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right.
It doesn't take a two-thirds vote to increase a measure 11 cents, I don't believe.
Could I ask a question?
Yes, doing good. Okay.
Senator Gordon, do you have any idea the number of how many people you have in prison now under Measure 11?
Chairman, Senator Courtney, I believe I want to say 30-some percent right now under Measure 11.
Okay, and if you increased every member's ballot Measure 11 person's sentence by 3 days, because you couldn't selectively do one and not the other, what would be the cost to the state of Oregon?
It goes to Ways and Means.
I realize that, but I'd like to know the cost off the top of your head of how much that would cost the state budget for this biennium.
I'm working here.
Excuse me?
I'm trying to do the math.
Be conservative.
Claudia's coming up to help you now.
The calculator.
Oh.
Yeah. It wouldn't be everybody, right?
How many people are scheduled to get out on
how
Friday?
How much is this going to save?
You can't. You cannot do that.
I know.
If you're going to increase one, you have to increase others.
And actually, Senator Barr's got
across the board. Across the board.
How much money does
this
save?
Do this. How much money does this save? It'd be the exact number.
That's fine. We can get to both. We can get to both. I have no problems with that.
What can you, Peter, go say if the sentence falls on a weekend, we're going to increase it 3 days? Put that statute.
You cannot do that. You cannot do that for one versus another. Go ahead.
Chairman, Senator Carney.
I think you guys should have paid attention to Senator Beyer, is what I think.
Listen to him. He was on the first
time. You know, kind of dialogue here a little bit before.
We've just been trying to do the math, and given the quick parameters, we'd say $15,000-$20,000 without, I mean, just we're trying to figure out how many are coming out in a three-day, doing the three-day times one biennium, and then how many are Measure 11. If we let, thank you, that look just helped me. We actually have 3,000 we let out a year, and I didn't do the math right, so we let 3,000 out at 3 days extra. We can do that again.
Chairman.
Senator.
If that amount, if you put 3 days on everybody's sentence, then somebody's still going to be getting out on Friday.
Oh, I said up to 3 days so the sentence does not end on a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
Up to 3 days, but if some people get out 3 days later,
you can't.
And other people get out earlier,
you can't.
Hang on a second. We're having a little counseling here.
Oh, this is terrible.
We're having a good time. This is fun. This is a big family here.
I want you out here for 3 o'clock. I can understand.
You're starting right in here?
I'm Daniel the Devil at 3 o'clock.
I think you.
You mean I don't have to go to rules today?
Go ahead.
Chairman, Senator Courtney, we now think we're at the $1,170,000.
Excuse me?
$1,170,000.
That's what I thought. You're over a
million. Take a million out of your budget.
You can redirect those funds.
Well, you're not going to spend it.
Is this a savings, by the way? Is there a reverse savings with this bill?
Chairman of Senator Gordon, just chairman, I guess. It will reduce a small way some of the numbers we have. I don't think we've anticipated it as a bed savings initiative.
You pulled up right quick, like.
People are going to vote the way I vote. Maybe you should get up there. Maybe you should have
those. Crazy.
I'll take a motion to send it home.
There's a motion on the table.
I would think you have to withdraw the motion. Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion to send it to the floor at this time, Mr. Chair.
Senator Courtney moves to withdraw the motion to send the bill to the floor.
Let the record show that the dash two amendments, though, were amended into the bill, so you are operating off the dash two amendments in terms of your deliberations, members of this committee, from here on forward, unless you want to get rid of that amendment as well. So we did amend the bill.
All right. Any objections to...
Send it out.
Not sending the bill.
Not sending it to floor, okay.
Okay, no objection. Then, we'll close the work session on this puppy. 2388. Who's on 2388? You know who you are, come up quickly.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, 2388 is the bill that we talked about last Monday in the evening that Mr. Livingston and I think Ms. Osborne were signed up for. I'm sorry, Senator Brown. This is the bill that we talked about on page 2 of the bill. This is the bill where if a counsel in a juvenile proceeding basically messes up and does not file the appeal, you'll recall we talked about that, and this is going to say that the counsel must file the notice of appeal at the trial level. I think the proponents are here, and I don't know if they've had a chance to talk to everyone.
We haven't been listening to this.
Yeah, I don't have any. Do you have any minutes? You want just to go on?
Yes, move it.
I move House Bill 2388A goes to Senate House floor. The Senate floor do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2388A and goes to the floor. The Senate will do pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections?
No.
Hearing none. So, order. Do we have the amendments to 370 yet?
I don't know. I got. You got only amendments left to 293, Mr. Chair.
Work session 293. Let's talk about this. This is basically
okay.
A bill being converted from a bill to a referral, and it is a repeat property crime offender.
Oh yeah.
Bill.
Yeah.
So that the people of the state of Oregon,
yep,
might have an opportunity.
Yep. Yes, sir. Jeez.
I should have known.
The birds have left the tree, baby.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 293 is a referral to the people. This mirrors Senate Bill 664-2, which is a rewrite of the repeat property offender bill that we had a session ago. So this would be a referral to the people. If you look on the last page of the bill, on page 4, the amendments would become effective July 1, 2003, and this would put it to the vote in the next general election.
Okay. All right.
Mr. Chair,
I'm Senator Courtney.
I move the one amendments to House Senate Bill 293.
Senator Courtney moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 293. Discussion? Any objection? Hearing none.
I move Senate Bill 293 is amended to Senate floor to pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 293 is amended to the floor of the Senate to pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Hearing none. So ordered, and I will carry this bill.
Mr. Chair, yes. I think Senator Courtney should notice the logo.
Sure he did.
Now, are we going to get our amendments to 370 or not? Virginia, if you're listening, I'd like you to know where they
are. Scales of justice. Call me again.
That's a weird scale of justice.
What time is it over?
It shouldn't look like that. It should look like the other.
You've got to move for
it. It should be way up here.
We'll be in recess until 4:50.
What?
4:50.